again, I'm going to close that door because it's facilitating a nice chilly breeze on my back. This is a session about change. It's about change in churches, but it's also about change in institutions and individuals. Many of the characteristics of change that we experience as persons are the same kinds of things that institutions and communities experience as well. Yesterday, Mike Mullen, at his session on Kennedy's speech to the Southern Baptists, said at one point, "I'm a historian. I don't want to get bogged down in the here and now." Well, I want to get bogged down in the here and now. In fact, we all are bogged down in the here and now, and one of the things that bogs us down most is dealing with change, again, individually and in our communities. Let me begin by reading briefly from Paul's letter to the Corinthians, the first letter, chapter 11, beginning with verse 23. "For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way also, after the cup, after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes.'" Familiar? Have you heard those words before? What do we call them?
Institution.
Thank you. The words of institution. There's a reason for that. If you remember how this passage continues, Paul goes on to talk about whether the church at Corinth is, in fact, sharing the Lord's Supper appropriately or not, how they institute the institution of the Lord's Supper has some import for Paul with the faithfulness of the church.
Mark, what do disciples call those words?
They call them the words of institution.
Okay.
Yeah. But we focus on the remembrance part. Right. You know, that debate's really interesting. I didn't go into this last night, but there was a wonderful dialogue and conversation between Luther and Zwingli on the efficacy of the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. And do this in remembrance of me, or the body of Christ broken for you, the blood of Christ shed for you, was the content of their very collegial disagreement. It's fascinating. In that point in the Reformation, there was a very collegial conversation between Zwingli, one of the Swiss reformers, and Luther. And disciples' understanding of the Lord's Supper goes right back to Zwingli. So it's kind of fun to watch these things persist over hundreds of years.
Did one of them win?
No, neither of them. I think, you know, they listened. They tried carefully to make observations. It's really intriguing when you read Luther and Zwingli's conversation. It's really quite fun. It's a good thing. It really is a good thing. They did well there. And you know, Luther doesn't always have such a great rep in terms of disagreements with others. So. All right. The church is centered around this institution. Institutions are all around us. Holden Village is a transitory community sustained by institutions. Buildings, part of that institution. Budgets, staff, board. These kinds of things provide what I call, at the Disciples' House, structures of community. Those are the things that hold communities and their values together over time. I remember being in high school choir and singing a version of a Walt Whitman poem, which had in it the words, "Sail, sail thy best, ship of democracy, of value is thy freight." I like the way that speaks about how structures and institutions can carry a treasure within them. And you know, the church has lots of structures and institutional aspects, and oftentimes they get a bad rap, and deservedly so. Let's just say that right out there. Yesterday I used the phrase, can these bones live? And I'm not sure. I hope they can. I hope the structures that support the community of faith can, in fact, be made more faithful so that they serve the ends of God's call for God's community in this place and this time. And that's kind of what I'm about. That point can be made in other ways as well. Max Weber, sociologist, talked about how religions come into being. Religion is not a dirty word to me. I just think it's a descriptive term. And he talks about how most religions seem to emerge from some sort of moment of spirit, charism, gift, spirit. But that over time they become institutionalized. They formalize their ways of being together, their processes. Those who once held positions of authority on the basis of clear gifts begin to hold positions of authority on the basis of occupying an office, wearing the right clothes, and so forth. And Weber traces this sort of institutionalization and bureaucratization in all sorts of human movements, but particularly in relation to religion. He seems to indicate that the development of patterns and structures and habits is fairly inevitable in human communities. I mean, I think that's the implication of Weber's study, is that we can't really escape being institutionalized. And if I take that seriously, that really does mean that we need to learn to live with those better rather than cast them out. So when I grew up, the phrase institutional church was pretty much not a good thing. And we oftentimes thought in terms of the visible church and the invisible church. That's a contrast from Augustine. And it was clear which side we wanted to be on. We wanted to be on the side of God, the invisible church. And in many cases, we cast out the visible. I think we can be about finding ways to get it right and to be more redemptive in terms of how the church lives in the world. Man, it's boring, isn't it?
Yeah.
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 If you should scroll your slides fast, because when power goes out, we can use it. Remember when you saw it?
I would make the point that much of the New Testament is a story of how the early Christians began to institutionalize and figure out how to do it and get it right. How do we do communion appropriately? Acts chapter 15 is a story about who's in and who's out, or, you know, is everybody in? 1 Corinthians 14 talks about once we start to formalize and institutionalize, what do we do when the Spirit erupts in unanticipated ways? And, you know, I think Paul is pretty clear in terms of saying, well, yeah, these prophets are good. It's good to have prophecy in the church, but it ain't worth much unless we got an interpreter. Those kinds of things are developments of patterns of living together that are going on throughout the church. Wow, I'm even getting ahead of my notes. This is pretty good. Paul's principle, in almost every case when he's dealing with a dispute, is to talk about what is it that edifies or builds up the body of Christ. That really is his prime criteria. What builds the body of Christ? I have alluded to this at least a couple times. Institutions, however, even when we work at them hard and try to edify and build them up and do our best, they seem also inevitably to fall into sin. Sin crouching at the door. Personally, for each of us and for our communities, no one is righteous, no, not one. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Augustine again talks about sin as, you know, his prayer about my heart is restless till it rests in thee. He understands the impulse of the soul in faithfulness to be yearning toward God. Sin for Augustine is when that impulse turns in upon itself and upon the person who is yearning toward God. And I think his word is incurvatus se, a kind of turning inward. Tillich talks about religious symbols, and I would say that the church and all the structures within it function as symbols for Tillich. And he talks about how we tend to set these things up and then we forget. So the whole notion of prophecy as reminding us of the grounding of in faith and in faithfulness of the things we do and how we do them, this sort of forgetfulness, we need to be called back to the grounding again in the one true God. So sin does infect everything we do. We seem to focus on the ways, in terms of change, and the ways in which externals of late have been forcing change upon us. So in the last 25 years, contemporary worship has been forced upon us by different forms of music and the culture around us. Churches over the last decade have been trying to adapt desperately to the internet and social media. Change does seem to come upon us in that way. But if we take Augustine and if we take Tillich seriously, an internal quality of faithfulness or faithlessness relatively also demand that we change. This week I've been trying to talk about, the overarching thing I've been trying to talk about is adaptive challenges. And this comes out of some thinking and writing by Ronald Heifetz in his book Leadership Without Easy Answers. I've talked about scarcity, quality. Tomorrow we'll talk about GLBTQ issues in the church, all of these as adaptive challenges to communities of faith. And today I'm going to try to talk about change as an adaptive challenge. Quick review, what's an adaptive challenge? There we go. come on, it's either one or the other. Adaptive challenges. We don't know the answer. Sometimes we don't even know the right question. There's a clash of values with reality. We're out of touch. That's the externals, or value with value, internal things. Change and adaptation are necessary if the institution is to continue to function, and some sort of loss will be required. And again, that wonderful quote from E.B. White, if the world were merely seductive, that would be easy. If it were merely challenging, that would be no problem. But I arise in the morning torn between a desire to improve the world and a desire to enjoy the world. This makes it hard to plan the day. We face adaptive challenges in many levels. Change is one in the church. It inevitably entails the unknown. We don't know what we're doing. The unknown causes anxiety. We know that there will be loss. Loss is difficult, we grieve, and we fear. We are not rational. I'd say that's one of the biggest things to think about when we think about change. It's not something that's rational, particularly when you multiply it in communities. We seem to want to forget that change is not rational. Okay, what do we think about when we think about change? How does it happen? Is it sudden and radical, like the French Revolution? Big changes in a hurry. Is it a little more gradual and incremental, like the Scottish Enlightenment? Those folks were not so much interested in breaks with the past as they were on building on the past. Is it epidemiological? I'm always pleased when I can get that word out. How many of you have read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Tipping Point? A few. It's a fun read. I think that's the point Gladwell tries to make, that in cultures in particular, change often percolates along for a long time at a slow level. And then what is it that causes things suddenly to change? And he compares it to the spread of germs in the environment. And it's a fun read and an interesting argument for us to take into account. Does change come about because of overwhelming outside forces such as social media or internal impulses, clashes of values like the worship wars that many of our churches have had? Is change, in the church in particular, more like what happens when traditions change? I have not had the chance to reflect on this as much as I would like. And I think I'm going to be interested to hear what you have to say about this. This thought occurred to me, I hope I'm not jumping ahead too much, when Earl Scruggs died a few months ago. Anybody know who Earl Scruggs is? Okay. Well, in Nashville, when things like that happen, that's front page banner headlines. And in the Tennessean, it was the whole front page and about five inside pages as well. Earl Scruggs was, a few years ago, our son Matt, who was here at Holden for a year as head maverick, before he came, took me to an Earl Scruggs review concert at the Ryman Auditorium. And that's often called the Mother Church of Country Music. It's the place where all the broadcasts of the Grand Ole Opry originated for decades and decades. It's an old church that was started by an evangelist who used to be a riverboat captain on the Cumberland and Mississippi rivers. And it's a beautiful old building restored in the mid-90s. And you sit in curving church pews facing the stage, and just about every star of country music has performed there over the decades, including Earl Scruggs. As Matt and I were walking up to the Ryman, there's a historical marker that says, on December 14th, I think it was, 1945, Earl Scruggs joined Bill Monroe and his Bluegrass Boys, and for the first time integrated three-finger style banjo picking, which is now known as Scruggs style banjo, into Bill Monroe's band, and bluegrass music was born. You've got a tradition of music that literally can be dated, you know, December 14th, I think it was, 1945, when Earl joined the band. And you all know the Beverly Hillbillies theme, you know, that's Earl Scruggs playing on that. And Matt and I got to see him on that same stage probably a couple, 3 years before he died, after walking past that historical marker. For a banjo player, that's almost like going to Lourdes or a holy site. One of the things, the comments that was made about Earl in the newspaper after he died was how adaptable he was. He starts this tradition that in many ways has a real cadre of purists. And yet he was a boundary crosser. Everybody who wrote about Earl talked about how he was a boundary crosser. In one of his albums in the late 1960s, make sure I get this right, 1972, he put out an album called I Saw the Light with a Little Help from My Friends. You catch that? Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. How do musical traditions change over time? They do, and sometimes in sudden and abrupt ways, sometimes in gradual ways. That's an interesting thing to reflect on, because the church represents a tradition as well. Well, here are some ways of just understanding, thinking about change. I'm not trying to claim these are comprehensive. I want to say these are suggestive and that we might be able to add to this list some observations that I make on change. Everybody, every organization experiences it. We think the pace of change is increasing. I know I've seen studies that have pointed toward that, not necessarily documented it, but certainly, what is the law of, what's the law about computers that was formulated?
Moore's law.
And can you tell me what that is?
Moore's law is that every 18 months the computing power of a chip will double.
Okay.
And its size will reduce in half.
And you have probably seen and observed personally what I've seen reported in studies about the number of different things that are now on grocery store shelves as opposed to 20 years ago. The amount of different items carried in typical supermarket has climbed from about 3,000 to over 30,000. Are those indicative of the pace of change? Quite possibly. What does change bring? Well, loss, dislocation, and upset. It's not necessarily linear or rational. Holiness provides no exemption. Somehow we want to think that churches are exempt from change. They are not. Doing change better, I want to claim, this is a moral claim that I'm making here, that if we do change better, we not only minimize wasted energy on things that could be spent differently, we thereby maximize energy for faithfulness to God's call. And therefore, I'm making a claim that change is moral. We are called to do it as well as we can and not screw up, knowing that we will inevitably along the way. But it does relate to our faithful response to the one true God. All right, some strategies for change along the way. There was a great brief article in the New York Times back in December of 2010 by Stacy Schiff, who has recently published a biography of Cleopatra. And her article was called Cleopatra's Guide to Good Governance. Number one, obliterate your rivals. Number two, don't confuse business with pleasure. Number three, appearances count. Number four, go big or go home. Number five, never get involved in a land war in Asia. Might have been helpful for us. Under promise and over deliver. If you can't pay your debts, debase your currency. A friend of a friend may well be an enemy. And they talk about how Cleopatra made some serious enemies, for example, Herod. And good neighbors make good fences, control the narrative, and so forth. I think that biography sounds like a fascinating read because it does bring our kind of a Liz Taylor version of Cleopatra, puts it to bed and brings the real person back to us. Kind of fun, I think. All right, so what other strategies for change can we consider? This is just kind of my shorthand. Heart, head, hands, habits. What I'm going to point to when I talk about heart, a colleague of mine, a minister in Ohio, said you have to change the heart. If you want to bring about change in a church, you've got to change the heart of the minister first. And I think we heard Alan alluding to that style of change. Was it yesterday? When he talked about conviction and conversion. Kind of change people's hearts first. That is certainly one way of going about changing organizations or communities or nations. We have to change the hearts of individuals. A second one, when I say head, change people's thinking. One strategy for thinking about change is that if we can just get people to think right, things will follow and fall out appropriately. Psychotherapy maybe kind of relates to that. If we can talk out our issues and get clear about what's going on and understand them, then we'll change. Education certainly builds on this strategy. If we can only get people to see things in the right way, well, surely they'll become enlightened. Hands. Not quite a reverse of the prior two, but this one would say sometimes it's as effective to behave people into changes as it is to try to convince them or convict them. You with me on that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We had in our church, I think I mentioned we started a homeless shelter there, and the guy in the church who was the biggest pain in the neck, by far. He was the biggest pain in the neck, and he was ornery, he was conservative, he didn't like poor people, he thought it was their own damn fault, and just in all sorts of ways, he liked to complain. And he'd been there forever. He grew up in that congregation. Alongside, interestingly enough, his closest friend who grew up with him, they were the same age, was totally different in his outlook. But Stanley, the ornery guy, when we began this homeless shelter, one of the things we had to do was bring people in about 6:30 every morning to clean, and especially clean in the bathrooms. And Stanley was ornery and bigoted and prejudiced, but he was there cleaning the bathrooms every time we were open. I'm not sure he ever verbally expressed a change in heart or head to me, but his hands were there. That's another way of seeing change. Pam?
There's a psychological study on that. I think it was in the book Mistakes Were Made, but it's that phenomenon of the best way to sort of convert an enemy is to ask them a favor. Is that people report always more positive feelings towards somebody else if they have been able to help them in some way. Which, kind of sounds backwards, but that's the way it works.
Yeah, it does sound backwards, and I think we in the church have to work hard to not make that sound backwards. Mm-hmm. Because lots of times we can do well. In many cases, that's what the Christian life is about. You know, loving your enemy is about doing something you don't want to do and you don't think is right, but you are called to do it anyway. Okay, so habits, what's that? That's built on a kind of a way of understanding the growth of character. And I think in some ways the passage from Romans that we read last night alludes to that same way of understanding how people become better. Become different by doing and then building habits over time that build on prior things that lead toward some end that is more godly or faithful. Does that make sense? I think athletics, the arts of all kinds are based upon, we get better by practicing. Yes. The sort of linear and chaotic strategies for change, I'm going to spin out in a little more detail. Gil Rendell has written a book, I think, called Leading Change in the Church. It's a nice short little thing, Alban Institute. He does talk about Ronald Heifetz, but he also tries to lay out these two kind of typical ways we understand as strategies for change. You know this one, the brainstorming model. Okay, so we have a problem. We get a bunch of good, creative people together. We sit down, we brainstorm solutions, and then we pick one. We pick what we think is best, we implement it, right? That works all the time. Okay. Rendell also talks about this a more chaotic model, and he uses different descriptive terms. Instead of problem, he talks about pain. There's something out there that doesn't feel good or that is wrong. We explore possibilities. That's not terribly different from brainstorming, but again, different language. In the process of exploring possibilities, we experience the wilderness. It's a lot like Heifetz and his concept of adaptive challenges which lead us into places we do not know. Chaos is a difficult thing to figure out. We give it, instead of ranking solutions and choosing one rationally, we give it creativity. I've talked about experimentation as one way of dealing with adaptive challenges. We give it sustained attention. What does that entail? Well, that could entail experimentation and discernment. It could entail extended scripture study. It could entail dialogue. It could entail teaching. It could entail prayer, community prayer. It could entail fasting. There are lots of ways that Christian people give sustained attention to chaos and pain. And then finally, we seek to make a faithful choice. A little bit different. Just a little bit different way of looking at how things happen. Here's another way to think about strategies for individuals and communities to face into change. Asking questions rather than proposing solutions. Is it better for us to think about good questions to ask, especially in fuzzy, vague, values-driven organizations like churches? Emotional, non-rational types of things. Sometimes we simply have to spend a good deal of time sitting with understanding where and who we are. So, where are we? Just knowing where we are is sometimes a critical thing and a good discipline to ask. Who are we? What time is it? So many communities that are multi-generational have to ask themselves repeatedly, what time is it? Because our habituated responses upon which we have built might no longer fit the time. Does that make sense? And what's going on? The notion of a thick description is a sociological term that has been tossed around quite a bit in the last 10 years, maybe even longer, emerged in the 70s. But it is exactly this that sometimes we need to do. We need to just sit and look and observe and question and seek to propose. Not to give answers, but to seek to propose. Yeah, Jen?
But I'm a member of a church where we love process.
You look what? Oh, you love process. Yeah.
And we can talk a thing to death.
Yeah.
You know, rather than get on with it.
Right.
So that wariness there.
Right.
And you can ask these questions, but the point is to move forward in some way. To move. To come up with a plan of action and implement.
Well, is that the point?
Depends what it is.
Committed to process, accepting of outcome.
Ah, that's a nice balance. You know, I tend to, the ministry students I work with, you know, they're all Protestants. They've been shaped by American Calvinism, no matter what stripe they are. And they study all the time, but after they've been out in ministry for 3, 4, 5 years, they become pragmatists. They become practical problem solvers. And one of the habits we try to inculcate, I'm not sure if it's successful at all. Well, yeah, it varies. Let's put it that way. It depends. is not jumping to an immediate solution, but to rest with the problem for a while. You know the notion of the Quaker Clearness Committee? Parker Palmer has written about this. It's a way in which the church can assist individuals who wish some assistance with clarifying their response to a situation in their life. And a number of folks will gather with a person and sit down for a day's conversation. Reflection, discernment, honesty, and love. That's something that we, I think, point to with these kinds of questions. How can we move toward clear discernment of God's call for us? Yes?
And pardon me if this is something you're going to get to later, but it seems to me one of the questions that certainly gets asked in the church context, either gets asked or people want to ask it, is why should we change?
Yeah.
I don't know how many people join the church because they want to change. And
Well, and again, that's a wonderful question that would be worth sitting with for a while, wouldn't it? When someone poses it, why should we change? Great, why should we? The kind of counselor's trick.
Why do you answer a question with another question?
Yes, there we go. Do I?
Why not?
Sitting with the questions and exploring them thoroughly before jumping to solutions, but then seeking some sort of faithful choice, was the previous slide. I think we have to hold the package together, because you're right, we oftentimes like to study things to death, and nothing really happens, because we're stuck in the head model. And we want to, I think, remember that we want to look toward heart and habit as well.
Mark?
Yes?
I think one of the things that concerns me about the way we function in some of these strategies is getting too hyper-focused on a narrow problem. And in our denomination, for example, before we had the sexuality discussions, we had these questions about Episcopal succession or ordained people. And as opposed to asking questions broadly about who we are and what time it is and how various points of view about ministry authority fit into this project of being community and in mission for God and so on. I mean, it gets so focused. And that's when I think process just really burns down. It's just so problem-focused, and the problem is only a few millimeters square.
And those, I mean, I think what's hard in the church is that, of course, people bring their habits from all the rest of life into this.
Yes.
And so if they're trained in their workplace to identify a problem and solve it and have a strategy and we're going to measure it, we got numbers, and we got, I mean, and to move very quickly, because a lot of people in their work lives, you know, it's like this, trying to keep up with whatever the changes in their industry.
Right.
And then for us to take a bunch of volunteers and say, okay, we're going to spend a lot of time discussing, you know, it's sometimes really hard as a community to sort of put the brakes on those habits and sort of say, okay, we can do this and ask broader questions. But it requires a lot of commitment from people to stay in that conversation and to keep showing up for that conversation and not miss big portions of it, because the rest of life is still going this fast.
Remind me to talk about other options than just conversation.
Yeah.
I feel like change brings out a lot of feelings and a lot of anxieties.
Yes.
Part of the reason that I personally will make a quick decision is that I just want to get that pain, that anxiety over with, and then I can settle into whatever decision I've made, and I can hate it or I can love it, but I'm done with that icky transition time that I can't stand.
Right.
So I'm trying to work on that personally to just breathe and be okay with that icky transition kind of feeling.
Yes.
It's hard to do.
It is awful. Right before we left, we were shopping for a car. We're trying to downsize. And we got down, you know, we spent 2 weeks and started with 6 or 8, and then we got down to 2. And we couldn't drive one of the options because there weren't any of them around. And, you know, Bonnie and I are both going, we've put all this work in, and we want to get it done before we leave, because we're going to be gone for 2 weeks, and, you know, it's just tough to live without resolution. But that is, I'll take you back to the chaos and the adaptive challenge and the unknown. That is, in many cases, our situation before God and with one another. We don't know. So a few other questions and then some other options to think about, too. If you want to walk in as a person thinking about a need for change in a community, you might also be asking, what have we inherited? What can we affirm? What must be changed? And who are our allies? You hear a different tone to that set of questions? It's a more directed approach.
Would you say those verbs again?
Sure. What have we inherited? What can we affirm? What must be changed? And who are our allies?
Okay.
I first ran into those questions in an article called Four Questions for the New Pastor. They have a little more directionality attached to them, don't they? Particularly that allies question that make you a little uncomfortable. Okay? It should. Other ways of living with these questions. At one point in time, we decided to, one of the problems with churches is they get so insular. It's almost impossible not to turn in upon yourself, not only external forces, but the internal forces of just being together in community. I call this a transitory community. Most congregations really are much less transitory, much more settled. And most of us in congregations are at the same place when we go to church. It might not be every Sunday. It might be three Sundays a month or something like that. But pastors are particularly constricted to one community and the forms that it has evolved. And you tend to lose sight of other options. So one thing that's really good to do is to form teams of people who will go out visiting and do that deliberately as a way of sitting with these questions. You can send a group of 3 to 5 or 6 people out to visit for a Sunday and to spend time with some folks from another congregation for a particular reason. That might be similar size, similar situation, or something you think you might want to be. That you're not. And, you know, folks can just do these visits and begin to soak up other options and learn more possibilities by seeing them in action. One of the usual issues that we run into, I think, in churches, perhaps other organizations as well, is the, what do they call it, the 7 last words of the church?
We
never did it that way before, yeah. Or we've always done it this way, yeah. How do you get past that? I think a kind of experimental attitude that says, well, that's true, we haven't, but here's a church over here that did, and we can think about it and talk to them, or we can try it for, as I said, I think yesterday, 3 months, and see what happens after 3 months, and we promise we're going to evaluate it, it's not going to become permanent, and then we'll give everybody a chance to see what it felt like and what they thought after we've actually done it. Those are the kinds of, you know, experimental, larger conversations that are less discussion for focused and more focused on gathering insight and wisdom from larger communities of faith. Does that make sense? And I think you can come up with a lot of creative ideas like that that will help foster conversation and foster a sharper, clearer, thick description of what's going on. Let's see. Other ways to think about fostering change. I mentioned education early. Certainly, study of the scripture is one of the church's most ingrained and appropriately ingrained and cherished practices. If we wish to seek change, there's a lot of rich material in the book of Acts. There's a lot of great stuff in all the epistles. How do communities of faith live together? And I wouldn't limit it to the New Testament. Reading the David stories as a cycle, for example, is just a wonderful way to watch how the people of Israel react over time with different forces impinging upon them and different ways of responding. You can do things like that. You can say, we are going to search the scriptures for a year. What's wrong with saying a year? There are churches that have said, we are going to declare a meeting sabbatical for a year. Why? Why not? Suspend other kinds of ingrained, habituated practices in order to focus in a different direction for a specified time for a certain reason. Another way to think about change in our communities is instead of the linear chaotic thing, a biblical image of the sower sowing seeds. How can we plant seeds for future difference that will grow 5-10 years up? I'm trying to go imaginative here and just and spark some ideas in you. I really like the notion of rising yeast. And if I can call that an evolutionary form of change, I'm tacking that word on here, not because Greg's in the room, but because Bonnie was able to attend some of Werner Jensen's sessions talking about the history of Holden. And she said, wow, if you really want a great example of how things just seem to evolve over time, they weren't necessarily envisioned and planned or envisioned and implemented, something would happen which would lead to a response which then was experienced as rich and valuable and needing to be preserved. Yeast rising can function in just that way. I've talked a little bit about discernment. There are a number of helpful books on discernment processes that you can easily get by Googling the word or going to Amazon. One, I think, is an Upper Room book by Charles Olson. This is a process of respecting difference and not necessarily planning to come to an outcome or a conclusion, but to say that difference is valuable because people are valuable, and what we can do is still come around a common table. Changing the ecology. Some folks who write about churches use what they call a systems theory approach. Any of you heard that language at all? Okay. Systems theory basically says that everything is connected. And if you actually do something over here, it's going to have an impact over here and over here and over here as well. And they might not be impacts that you can predict. So we don't know how the changes, the experimentation we might do in one particular piece of a community can impact the rest of it. Wow, the best way to think about that comes to my mind right now is you're talking to person A, and you're talking about something, and you don't realize that that person is related to 6 other people who are on a committee who have something to do with that which you are talking about. And all that kind of, you know, interrelatedness of human community functions in ways that we can't perceive. And it might function to come back and bite you, or you might be able to find ways to pull strings or push buttons that have an indirect, very indirect impact on things. Changing cultures and musical traditions, I think, fits this kind of more fuzzy way of change happening. Nobody knew when Earl Scruggs joined Bill Monroe what the impact was going to be. Nobody could predict Bella Fleck. You all know who Bella Fleck is, right? Okay, nobody could predict that in 1945. Appreciative inquiry is a kind of way of thinking about moving through change in communities and organizations. I think of this as building on your strengths, basically. Instead of doing a problem-solving approach, you look at what's good about what's going on, and you say, hey, that's our strength. Let's see what we can do to not only affirm that, but let's continue to build on those strong points and see where that leads us as a community and an organization. Vision casting, I'm really dubious about. And I throw that language out and say that very bluntly because it is everywhere in terms of what ministers encounter. So if you're in a church, you know, you've heard the language of we have to have a vision, and you've frequently heard it. If you hear the phrase vision casting, let your ears go up because it's code language. It gets used without hardly any content, any examined content. And it comes out of a more authoritative, evangelical, conservative, megachurch-style tradition in which, you know, the founding pastor is often the person who has the vision and gathers people around to implement that vision. it's a really top-down way of doing things, and therefore I'm suspicious of its appropriateness. It certainly has appropriateness in various places, but it often becomes one person's vision being put upon a whole community rather than a vision emerging in common from beneath, perhaps. Does that make sense? I'm not saying throw it out. I am saying, you know, there are two ways of thinking about this, and the coded way is often like that. Yeah.
Is it an old line, one I heard not too long ago, the only thing you can do well from the top down is dig a hole?
Vision does emerge from the bottom as well, if it's sought in community and in discernment. So, again, the liberation theology movement, the gospel solentiname, is that Ernesto? Yeah, I think I'm getting the wrong author on that one. It's Gutierrez. Yes, it's Gutierrez. You know, the whole notion of a base community, which is a small, intent community that engages in conversation, study, discernment, and out of that kind of stewing comes a vision, a common vision, is a different way of thinking about it than the sort of notion of vision casting, which is really common in our culture right now. And my problem with that is captured in this last statement. Let the form of change not do violence to the intended end. And here I'm picking up from Martin Luther King Jr., who picked it up from Gandhi, who apparently picked it up from Tolstoy. The means and the ends must cohere. Why is it that nonviolent resistance was the method of choice? Because if you're seeking a nonviolent, non-oppressive end, violence will not get you there. It will only engender more violence. Does that make sense? I think that's a really important thing. We muddle through. There are tips and tricks, and there are images and metaphors. This might be one of the most helpful pieces that you can take away, is means and ends must cohere. And I think that's all I've got. I'm open to hearing your conversations and questions and thoughts. We got about 3 minutes, I hope.
Many times you've spoken, you always mention it involves, change involves loss. And mentally, I've always added to that the word risk, because you can risk, but not necessarily have loss. But there's still something, it may be unnerving for some to take the risk in order to change.
Right. If I could build on that a little bit, the risk is in part because of potential loss. Does that make sense? And so overcoming that sort of fear of loss and the anxiety that that engenders is really difficult. And it's best done in community, and it's ironic that it's hardest to do in community. When we're joined with others in love and faithfulness, we ought to be able to risk more freely. But we find it hard.
Comment was made over here about people being changing at work. Do we change better when we're paid to? And then is part of our problem that the church is a voluntary organization?
Changing at work is mandatory.
Yeah.
Quick change at work, just as you suggest. And deadlines, if you don't do it, you're out and someone else will do it. But I think, on the other hand, for me, in experiences I've had, when we talk about change within the church, I'm in total agreement with Pam that we have to take a long time. But people drop out because they're not going to take the time. Or they're going to get through part of it and they're not going to listen to the rest, because it just, we've been there too long.
Or they'll tune out until it's the decision-making point, and then they'll say, well, wait, I wasn't consulted. Well, there were all these points along the way.
This is part of the chaotic thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's to be expected. It really is anticipated, and don't be surprised.
Yeah.
It is non-rational. It is non-linear.
My comment about that is even when we decide on some change, sometimes after going through all that work, we really don't make any change. And then the people who really were invested will, are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And just a comment. I shared in another group that the cathedral, where I had been attending for many years, suspended its services. And so we had a congregation that was dispersed to the available churches in our metropolitan area. And over the course of the 3 months that have passed now since they closed, a number of people, probably 35 or so, have been emailing around the results of the visitations that they've been making, in the course of which, as a cathedral body, we've been discovering what our core values really are, so that when the next bishop comes and the potential option exists of reopening the cathedral, we've got a lot more clarity about what the things are that are drivers for us, the rubbing points where in these other congregations we've visited, the change that we see there is or isn't congruent with what we view of our role as ourselves as a community of God. It's just been really fascinating to watch that happen.
It's really good to be able to differentiate by experience. I just want to make one last comment, and it's time for us to break up. But I alluded to Dexter Avenue King Memorial Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama last night. And I mentioned that we stopped to visit on the way back from a trip in the spring. That church is almost defunct at this point in time. And when I just tell you that because I have had a couple of conversations about sustainability in terms of what we do as organizations, communities, and churches in particular. And I'll say this and hope it doesn't cause further grief, because I know it's a grief-filled thing to lose a church. Churches are finally penultimate. And traditions come and go, congregations come and go. Sometimes it's time for them to cease. I had breakfast with somebody else whose church just closed up in the last few months, I think. And so we do our best. We try to be faithful, and we trust in God. And sometimes that means some things go on, and sometimes it means they come to an end, and faithful ministry continues in other ways, in other places, as the Spirit moves it. Yeah. Last question, and then we'll go.
I think we have a lot of sentimentality attached to buildings, but just from my own experience, I'm the interim janitor at our church, and I get to mop the floors and wipe the altar, all these things, and it's really about church being kind of a space where the holy can happen, but the building in itself is not holy.
True.
So,
but it does become dear.
Yes.
And that's
when we have to separate it.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for listening and for being with me today.